Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Pleased to be with you this Sunday morning. Coming up later in today's program, commentary from Bob Brekka. Bill Felker has this week's Fort Wills Almanac, and Dennis Grant with United Rehabilitation Services talks about a major expansion underway at their facility and how they're helping more people than ever with disabilities. Up first, this week on Dayton Youth Radio, we have the final segment of a three-part series where Miami Valley teenagers talk about race. Here's project manager Basim Blunt.
Last week on Dayton Youth Radio, we heard from Mandela Brown, who's 18, and talked about being stopped three times by police officers in his community. Today, we'll hear from Mandela's classmate at Centerville High School, Travis Grile, who is 17 and the son of a police officer. Travis wrote and produced this story a few months after five police officers were ambushed and killed in Dallas, Texas.
I'm Travis Grile, and I'm a senior at Centerville High School. I'm white. I remember when I was a young kid and someone would ask me what my parents do for a living. My reply was always the same. I'd talk about my mom first because, well, her job at a local car dealership was nothing out of the ordinary. But as soon as I got to my dad, being able to say that my dad was a police officer with a gleaming smile on my face made me feel special, unique, and proud. But if asked that question today in 2017, I doubt my reply would be as enthusiastic. Don't get me wrong, I've never been more proud of my father and what he does as a police officer. Things are just a little more complicated now.
I think there is such a divide right now between people. I think that has been furthered by the politicians, both in Washington and well as the states. I think it has been forwarded by the media, but ultimately it reflects on the opinions and attitudes of the people in the country.
That was my dad. I decided it's probably best to not use his name. For as long as I've been alive, he's been a police officer. If you watch the news, or even if you don't, I'm sure you've seen the countless stories about the tragic death of an unarmed black American citizen at the hands of the police.
Have any of these incidents personally affected you?
Yeah, I think they have all affected me and my profession. I think what it has done, it's compelled the police officers to be more outwardly community-focused. While all along the community has been their focus, I think they're doing more external events and external actions to reinforce that message.
I'm doing the story with Mandela, a classmate. He's black and he's been stopped with the police before for no reason and he's very frustrated. Is there anything you would say to him?
First thing, I would challenge Mandela, and I also know Mandela and his parents. I would challenge him to when he says for no reason. Mm-hmm. He may have not been articulated a reason. He may not have agreed with the reason. But I truly believe that 99.9% of law enforcement officers out there, when they stop someone, they are enforcing some violation or following up on some bit of information they have that makes that stop credible. So I would love to speak to Mandela about individual incidents and try to fill in the rest of the picture.
Have you ever had second thoughts about your career?
Never. It's been a great career. It's been a privilege to serve the public. For every negative story that's out there, I think every police officer could probably give you dozens of positive stories themselves that they were involved in.
Have you ever had to fire your gun?
Not at a human being.
So what is that? Like, have you've used it then before?
Obviously for training and to destroy injured animals.
On the night of July 7th, 2016, five officers were shot and killed in Dallas, Texas, by a deranged man who was angry at whites for recent police shootings. This was the deadliest day for law enforcement in America since 9/11. Being the son of an officer, this has directly impacted me. The thought that my dad or even I might be the target to someone just because of their resentment towards police is more than troubling. I know just because, you know, I'm in high school and I hear kids talk and I know the general vibe or emotion or feeling towards police is not a positive one. But we must always remember one thing. No matter what color you are, no matter what profession you have, no matter who you're related to, no matter what, we are all Americans and we deserve to live a happy, safe life. The question is, what can we do to fix this? For Dayton Youth Radio, this is Travis Grile of Centerville High School.
That was part two of a two-part Dayton Youth Radio story entitled We Are All Americans, written and produced by Travis Grile at Centerville High School. Special thanks to Travis's dad and his teacher, Trisha Raypak. To hear more stories from this series, visit WYSO.org or subscribe to the iTunes podcast. For Dayton Youth Radio, this is Project Coordinator Basine Blunt.
Support for Dayton Youth Radio comes from the Virginia W. Kettering Foundation and the Armott Boyer Charitable Trust, Fifth Third Bank Trustee. The 1966 film Black Girl from director Osman Simbene will be shown at the Little Art Theater in Yellow Springs on March 4th. Simbene is considered the father of African cinema. And to tell us a little bit more about him and the film is Assistant Professor of Media Arts at Antioch College, Charles Fairbanks.
Osman Simbene was Senegalese, but he went to France when Senegal was a French colony. He stowed away on a ship and then worked in a car factory, then worked on the docks there as he was writing his first novels. And then after the independence of Senegal, he went back and made what some think the first film and then first feature film made by a black African filmmaker. And that first feature film was Black Girl, which not only was the first, but was and is one of the greatest films in the world, one of my favorite films in the world.
And tell us why that is.
Well, it's hard to say why you love something so much. I showed an excerpt in my class last year, and just with this three-minute excerpt, I started crying in front of my class. It has touched me so deeply. So Black Girl, it's about post-colonial relations. A French couple living in Senegal hires a Senegalese woman to be their servant. Eventually, they all go back to France, and the situation changes drastically. And so it's a lot about racism. It actually echoes a lot with contemporary struggles, even as it's a portrait of the post-colonial world.
And there will also be a short film by Charles Burnett. The New York Times has called him America's least known great filmmaker and most gifted black director.
So Charles Burnett went to film school at UCLA, where he discovered the work of Osman Simbene. UCLA was unique among film schools, being in a public institution and having an interest in forming filmmakers who were, from more popular backgrounds. And Burnett and several people in his cohort formed what eventually became known as the LA Film Rebellion, a group of black filmmakers who were making films that went that cut against what Hollywood was producing, both mainstream cinema and even the blaxploitation pictures that were also coming out of Hollywood.
The film Black Girl will run on Saturday, March 4th, 1 o'clock in the afternoon at the Little Art Theater in Yellow Springs. And this is free admission.
Free admission. We do suggest a donation of a can of non-perishable food. We're trying to raise, help fill up our local food banks. But also there's a connection to the films in the program.
Charles Fairbanks is assistant professor of media arts, and you're also a filmmaker, correct? Tell us a little bit about what you've done.
I am a filmmaker. I've made five different short films that are all either about my parents or about wrestling of some sort in Mexico, in the U.S. And I just finished my first feature film, which is a documentary set in Chiapas about a shaman who falls under the spell of a pyramid scheme marketed nutritional supplement and then looks to me, the director, to help him buy into the pyramid scheme.
And that just premiered?
Its world premiere was in Switzerland last April, and it just had its U.S. premiere at Slam Dance, where it won a jury prize. I've actually been surprised how warm the reaction is right now in the U.S. It's been selected for a lot of film festivals, even though it's not in English, mostly not even in Spanish. It's in a language called Zoque and has subtitles in English.
Charles Fairbanks, thanks for speaking with us again. The film Black Girl will run Saturday, March 4th at the Little Art Theater, and that is 1 in the afternoon. Charles, good luck with your film and good luck with this event.
Thank you very much.
This is WISO Weekend. United Rehabilitation Services in Dayton is undergoing a big expansion to their facility, and they're also starting a massive public capital campaign to help with their growing needs as they serve more and more children and adults with disabilities. Here's CEO Dennis Grant.
Well, you know, historically, we've served about 300 to 400 individuals with disabilities each day between our community employment program, our home-based care, occupational, physical, and speech therapy. But we're really focused right now on growing our child care program as well as our adult day services program, which includes vocational training as well as adult daycare for seniors and those with complex conditions. You know, we've been working on this for about 3 years now. You have to really plan ahead. But as part of our strategic planning process, we had waiting lists for our child care and adult programs for 2 years. So we decided we needed to do something, so we launched a project called Unlocking Possibilities, which really is focused on adding about 55% onto our building as a phase one process so we can double the number of children we serve to 120 to 125 a week. We can also serve an additional 100 adults. So instead of 100 adults a day, that could go to 200 or even more potentially.
Your expansion actually comes at a very good time because there were some state mandates passed down 2 or 3 years ago?
Well, it's about 3 years ago now. The Center for Medicaid and Medicare indicated that all the states had to get out of the business of providing adult day services because it was a competing effort against private providers such as URS. So we began in 2014 actually planning ahead for this project. And what it really, you know, the implications are in Montgomery County, we have over 600 adults with disabilities that are served by the County Board of Developmental Disabilities. And they're planning to reduce the number served by 70% by 2019. So for us to be able to expand our capacity dramatically right now, it's really a key for them because we want to create a seamless transition for those individuals and to support them and their families through this process. So the fact that we've actually begun accepting new clients in our adult day program and in our child care just in the last few weeks, things are really starting to take off, and that waiting list is disappearing.
Now, this also affects other organizations that are providing services for people with disabilities in the area as well, correct?
Well, exactly. And, you know, we're one of probably a dozen organizations that provide similar services for adults throughout the area. However, I think the important thing is that, you know, we provide that care where we have nurses on staff who can really address the, you know, critical medical needs of many of the people. Our history of being United Cerebral Palsy of Greater Dayton, you know, over a third of the people who are coming here now have been here over 30 years. And we actually have two clients who started with us over 60 years ago when we were formed in 1956. So it's really something special that we're able to offer this community. And, you know, I think it's the unique nature of the services we provide, much like our early childhood education center. You know, when you look at this, it's not just child care. We are a 5-star rated early childhood education center under the Step Up to Quality program here in Ohio. And that's really special because not only are we able to help kids with disabilities to be able to be ready to learn when they enter kindergarten, but because we serve their typically developing siblings as well, we're able to provide that same high-level curriculum and the quality of service that ensures that all children are ready to learn when they enter school and to support them throughout their childhood, because we also provide before and after school care for kids with disabilities up to age 17 and all summer long, full days.
The public portion of your capital campaign, let's talk about numbers. How much do you have left to raise and what are your next steps?
Well, we've been in the quiet phase for about 2 years, and on a $6 million project, we've actually raised about $5.6 million. So we launched the public campaign a little while ago. We've raised about $100,000 since then. We actually have a challenge match that several individuals put up over $50,000 in matching funds. So every dollar someone donates right now will help us to make up that extra $400,000 that we need to complete this project. But we are very excited because phase one was adding over 21,000 square feet to our building, enhancing not just the number of people we can serve, but the quality of that, including a new gymnasium and recreation area, arts and activities rooms. But we're also in the process of remodeling our interior spaces, including remodeling the restrooms, expanding our kitchen, because we are one of the few people that provides hot meals. We do breakfast, lunch, and snacks all day long. And for adults or the kids that come here, it's really a high-quality food. We use a lot of whole grains, organic foods. We actually have our own garden that the adult clients grow, and we use our own organic foods in our kitchen. And it's great because we have a newly remodeled apartment kitchen where the adults are actually taking cooking classes. So it's really pretty good. And I had some great muffins the other day. You wouldn't have believed. So.
How do your clients feel about the expansion? I imagine exciting news around here for quite a while.
You know, they are probably more thrilled than I am, which is hard to believe. But, you know, during the construction phase, you don't know how many barriers we had to put up because everybody wanted to go see it. And until it was really open and safe, we really couldn't allow for that. But we've had several open houses, and the clients and the families have been coming in to see it. And it is just remarkable. I think you'll be amazed if you can take the time. And we do offer tours to the community on a regular basis. Every month we either have a breakfast or a lunch meeting that includes a short presentation and a tour. So we encourage people to go to our website at ursdayton.org and learn more about what we do, but also come see it firsthand, because if you can see the mission in action, it will change your life. It certainly changed mine.
Let's talk about future challenges before we wrap up from the state or federal level.
Well, I tell you, on one hand, we are thrilled to death that Governor Kasich's budget proposal at this point includes an additional $100 million committed to people with developmental disabilities here in the state of Ohio over the next biennium, 2018-2019. And that is an amazing thing, and it's really important for us, especially as we see more and more people needing to have these Medicaid waivers to access services like ours. So that's a really great thing. One of the big challenges we're very worried about is a lot of the talk in the Congress at the national level in terms of block granting Medicaid dollars to the states, because this will mean putting a cap on what we're able to recover. And it'll mean that the state is going to have to prioritize where they devote those dollars. And we know that, you know, with the kind of graying of America, the nursing home industry is growing rapidly. That draws a lot of the money out of the system. And if we're capped at a certain level, we know that that's going to pull away from that $100 million Governor Kasich wants to put into this. The important thing to know about that $100 million that Governor Kasich is committing, the state of Ohio only has to put up about 40% of that. The rest of that is federal money that is leveraged and brought into the state to purchase critical services for people in need, and it helps drive our economy. So we could potentially be giving up literally hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in federal money that could come into this state should that block granting actually occur.
Dennis, you mentioned your website. What other kinds of information there do you have for people?
Well, you can certainly go to our website. That's www.ursdayton.org. But we also have a specific platform, a website available called futureofdisabilities.com. And there you can learn more exactly about the Unlocking Possibilities campaign and pledge your support to this and make a difference in the lives of thousands of children and adults with disabilities right here in our community.
Dennis Grant, Executive Director of United Rehabilitation Services, thanks for your time and good luck with the rest of the completion of your expansion.
Thank you. We're looking forward to wrapping this up and moving forward. It's been a great experience, but it's going to be even greater in the future.
Politicians in Ohio and around the country are struggling to articulate new energy policies. Renewables are booming and becoming cheaper, but shale oil and gas are on the rise as well. How will the energy system of the future look? Sustainability commentator Bob Brekka has some ideas about pitfalls to avoid.
I'll admit right up front that I really like renewable energy. Knowing that sun shining on the solar panels on my roof is making hot water and electricity just makes me happy. The rise of renewables over the past decade has been breathtaking. Wind and solar have been doubling every few years. Renewables, including hydroelectric power, could be supplying a big fraction of the world's electricity in just a couple of decades. By the time my kids are my age, the world's energy system could look very different than it does now. That is, if other forces don't step in to stop this trend. For the first time in history, we are intentionally thinking about how energy will be used. We're looking at which kinds of energy will serve us best over the long term. And when I say we, I mean people in countries around the world, both rich and poor. But a lot of entrenched interests have grown very comfortable, not to mention wealthy, with the system as it is now. They have no interest in making changes. Ohio, like many other states, created laws to encourage energy efficiency and renewable energy. Programs that help us save energy can be the most cost-effective change we can make to the energy system. Groups like the Ohio Manufacturers Association support Ohio's energy efficiency programs because they see that members can be more efficient and save unnecessary costs. But coal and oil companies, or utilities distributing electricity or natural gas, have no incentive to help us buy less of their energy. Operators of old coal-fired power plants are under pressure because of competition from natural gas. Coal companies don't like to hear this, but they're looking more and more like, well, dinosaurs. In this case, the dinosaurs have a few tricks left, however. First, fossil fuel companies worked with legislators to try and kill Ohio's renewable energy standards, and they were temporarily successful until Governor Kasich recently used his veto power. Meanwhile, the big utilities like DP&L, AEP, and First Energy came up with plans to keep uneconomic power plants open and to get us to pay for their bad decisions. Some of these power plants are among the oldest and dirtiest ones, so there's no justification in an era of cheaper alternatives to keep them running. There's a model for how energy providers should not operate, and it's in Germany. When Germans created a set of ambitious renewable energy measures more than a decade ago, they were producing only a few percent of their electricity from sun and wind. Utilities laughed off these efforts and thought they would never be a threat to their business model. But almost overnight, renewables were suddenly over 30% of the electricity market. Operators of power plants found that they couldn't be profitable anymore. So what did they do? Among other things, they worked with politicians to gut some renewable energy programs. The result has been a sharp decrease in new solar photovoltaic installation in Germany, together with restrictive laws on wind turbines in some parts of the country. Sometimes big companies can be efficient, but they have a lot of inertia as well. If utilities and fossil fuel providers were really efficient and foresighted, they would see the changes coming down the road and transform themselves into broad-based energy companies. They would embrace a renewable energy future. If they refuse to do so, they will find themselves going the way of wheelwrights and makers of whale oil lamps. And personally, I'd love to have more people sharing the pleasure of making their own clean energy at home. For WISO, this is Bob Brekka.
Bob Brekka is a professor of physics and renewable and clean energy at the University of Dayton. He is research director of UD's Hanley Sustainability Institute and tweets at Bob Brekka. For more stories and commentaries, visit our website, wiso.org.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the third week of early spring, the first week of the Robin Chorus Moon. Each event in nature always points to other events, one part linked to so many other parts and ultimately to the whole. So the Robin Chorus, which begins this month along the 40th parallel, is a mine from which one might draw out numberless concurrent happenings, all of them together making spring. In this month of the Robin Chorus Moon, when robins start their sing-song calls in the morning twilight, then pollen forms on pussy willow catkins and the first mosquito bites. Moths appear at your porch light. Worms rise through the ground to mate as the sun warms the mulch above them and the moon waxes. The tufted titmouse courts in spirals. Flickers and purple martins migrate, and willow trees glow yellow-green. By the full moon of the Robin Chorus Moon, geese trumpet and converse. Turkeys gobble in the woods, and in the final days of the final lunar phase, trillium, hepatica, Dutchman's breeches, bloodroot, spring beauty, violet cress, and lesser celandine prophesy the sweetest time of year. The Robin Chorus Moon follows these and so many other events. It shadows and foreshadows them, possibly even causes some of them and connects them from the sky. It accompanies and enhances the waves of high and low pressure that cross the land, reflects the equinoctial sun, and finally grows dark as sandhill cranes start to migrate, stirred by the more radical warming and leafing and blossoming forces of middle spring to come. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the fourth week of early spring. In the meantime, start your pre-dawn vigils and listen for robins.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at WISO.org.
That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next Sunday morning at 10. And you can join me tonight as I co-host Alpha Rhythms with Juliet Fromholt. Just a little celebration to mark my 25 years on the air here at WYSO. We'll see you tonight. Coming up next, Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.
Hi, this is Luke Dennis. There's been a lot of buzz about Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me coming to the Schuster Center on September 28th, so here's the scoop. Regular tickets will go on sale at the end of July. Tickets plus the reception after the show with the cast will be offered for donations of $365 during our regular membership drive starting on March 7th. However, donate before March 7th, any amount, and we'll enter your name in a drawing for front row seats. All the details are on our website. Thanks.